It's Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. Ever since Watergate, Bob Woodward has been one of America's best-known investigative journalists. In 1989, he began the research for a book he planned to write about the Pentagon. The book ended up investigating how America decides to go to war, focusing on the invasion of Panama and the war in the Gulf. Woodward says nearly all of the information came from interviews with people directly involved in the decisions. The key sources were administration and Pentagon officials, both civilian and military. President Bush was not interviewed. Earlier today, the president announced that his nominee for director of the CIA is Robert Gates. Gates is currently the deputy national security advisor. I asked Woodward what role Gates had played in planning the Gulf War.
Well, he was a member of what they call the Big Eight, which includes the president, vice president, Secretary of State Baker, Secretary of Defense Cheney, and Colin Powell, General Colin Powell, the chairman of the Joint Chiefs, John Sununu, the White House chief of staff. He, in many ways, Gates acts as a co-national security advisor, along with Brent Scowcroft, who, of course, is the eighth member of this Big Eight. And somebody the president has great confidence in, apparently.
Gates had been nominated by President Reagan to be CIA director, but Gates withdrew his name because of questions regarding what he knew about the Iran-Contra affair. Do you think that there are Iran-Contra skeletons in Gates' closet?
I think there are Iran-Contra questions, as there were at the time, and that's the reason he took his name out. Because he was not able to answer them or able to answer them rapidly enough. His position as the deputy CIA director to William Casey, he knew a great deal about what was going on. He has not been charged with any crime. Many senators involved in intelligence work have questions about what he knew and when he knew it and what he did about it. And it's pretty clear from the record that he did not do a great deal about it. He just kind of said, well, keep me informed, and was not aggressive trying to get to the bottom of these so-called rumors and hints and, in fact, some direct statements that there was a diversion of funds from the Iranian arms sales to the Contras, which, of course, was illegal and something that really made the Iran-Contra affair what it was.
So you're saying that you believe that Gates knew about a lot of what was happening during Iran-Contra and allowed it to continue?
Well, in the latter stages of it, there are people who have testified from the CIA that they brought information to Gates. The record is fuzzy and ambiguous, and I think it will be most interesting to see whether there are new answers, whether there's new information, what the reaction of the Senate is to him.
What kind of CIA director do you think Robert Gates would make?
Well, he's a very smart man and knows a lot about the national security system, not only the intelligence end, but the National Security Council. He's worked as the deputy in the Bush administration. He worked in the NSC. He knows the ropes. I think he knows the kind of CIA director that Bush wants, which is somebody who's going to give intelligence information, present the facts, and not get involved in policy discussions.
If you're just joining us, my guest is Bob Woodward, and his new book is called The Commanders. Now, you started The Commanders before the war in the Gulf, even before the invasion of Panama. What were you initially looking for?
Trying to put together an account, as I had done in other books, like on the Supreme Court, The Brethren, or the book I did called Veil on the CIA, Institutional Profile, how the modern military after Vietnam functioned, how it worked, how it related to the White House and the Congress. I started this right after Bush was elected, of course, in 1989, as the Berlin Wall came down and people felt that communism was increasingly irrelevant and that it did not pose a military threat to the United States. There was some feeling the Pentagon was also irrelevant and not going to be a big deal. So in 89, I had, to a certain extent, free access to the place. No one else to my knowledge, was doing a book on the Pentagon at that time. And then came Panama and the Gulf War. I knew the people and the procedures and how it worked. And so I was able to develop on this book and really inside, sometimes hour by hour, day by day account of how the White House and the Pentagon made the decisions to conduct these wars.
Now, I'm just curious, after the Gulf crisis started, where were you in the sense of how did you get information? Did you get it from phone calls after planning meetings happened? Were you actually allowed in on any planning meetings?
I was not allowed in on any planning meetings. I got it afterwards in interviews, discussions, from notes, documents, records. They keep lots of information in the Pentagon and the White House. And because this was really about crisis management and so much was at stake, people were willing to talk about it. People had very specific memories about what was decided and when and what was said.
When do you think Bush decided to go to war?
I think there's no single moment. One of the things I was able to uncover is that there was a top secret warning order sent by the Pentagon with Bush's authority December 29th to Schwarzkopf in Saudi Arabia, telling him in a warning order as an official message saying, be prepared to launch, in this case, the war plan, the attack on Iraqi forces in Kuwait and in Iraq. Be prepared to do this at 3 a.m. January 17th. Now, that's, in fact, when the war began. So some 18, 19 days before, in a sense, all but the final push of the button had been decided. It puts in context certain things that went on in January, certain diplomatic efforts by the administration, also the effort to get congressional support for this. I suppose if it had come out at the time that Bush was locked and ready to go to war, there would have been perhaps a very different reaction in Congress, or some members would have had different reactions saying, what are we voting on? Are we voting on an authority when the president has already decided to do it, or are we playing some role here?
You quote General Powell as saying that he was really thrown on August 5th when President Bush said, this will not stand, this aggression against Kuwait. Powell knew that that should be interpreted as interpreted that we might be sending in troops to get Iraq out of Kuwait. He had not been informed about this. He had not been consulted about this. Were there ways that Powell was shut out of the decision-making process?
Well, I wouldn't say shut out. I think, as the book shows, he's very much a player in this. But what happened is, in the first days of the crisis, it was absolutely unclear to a lot of people in the Bush inner circle that Bush was going to use the military. Some people felt it was quite possible that he would. That Sunday afternoon when he got off the helicopter on the White House lawn and said, this invasion will not stand, he declared himself, the president did, in a very forceful and almost final way. It was a surprise to Powell. And he did not know that we were making this decision, that there really had not been a systematic way of laying out the alternatives and the options and the costs. Just the day before, as the book reports, General Schwarzkopf had told the president and Cheney and Powell that it would take 8 months to 12 months to build up enough force in the Middle East to eject Iraq from Kuwait, and that would be many, many months off. It would require force levels that no one at that point had even calculated, and here you have the president saying this is essentially what we're going to do.
So Bush decided to go ahead in spite of the fact that Schwarzkopf warned him it would take a longer time than Bush was counting on to mobilize
the forces. Well, it's not necessarily longer than Bush was counting on. It was the commander, General Schwarzkopf, saying in a very sensitive, top-secret briefing, this is how long it's going to take.
Right.
It again underscores, which I think is one of the themes of the book, that the president felt very, very committed to this and what was not going to be deterred by how long it might take.
My guest is journalist Bob Woodward. His new book, The Commanders, started out as a study of the inner workings of the Pentagon, but it ended up a study of how America goes to war, focusing on the invasion of Panama and the war in the Gulf. More after this short break. This is Fresh Air. If you're just joining us, my guest is Bob Woodward, and we're discussing the subject of his new book, The Commanders. You say that your book is really about the way America decides to go to war. So I have something I want to ask you about that. Now, you report that General Powell favored letting sanctions work longer, and he thought eventually the sanctions would be effective. They might take a year or two, but eventually they would work. But he wasn't going to, he was going to make the case for sanctions, but he wasn't going to say that he really favored sanctions unless somebody else in the inner circle spoke first.
Exactly.
On behalf of sanctions. What does that say about General Powell, and what does it say about the decision-making process in terms of really encouraging a lively debate before committing to go to war?
Well, it's interesting. People have, and you have properly delineated the subtlety of what Powell was doing. It was obvious to Powell, it was obvious to everyone, and I think to the American public, that the president felt very, very strongly about this and was almost beating the tom-toms himself. And Powell felt that the alternative of economic sanctions could work, and he, as we talked about earlier, finally presented it to the president. But it was done in this way, and I think this is true of most small or large organizations. There is something called indirect communication when you come into the boss and you say, look, A will work, B will work, and then you talk at great length about B, and you speak rather passionately about it, and the boss doesn't say, is that what you're recommending? No one really asks you any serious questions about it. No one says, yeah, I think we ought to do B, but it's pretty clear, and I surmise, I can't prove, and the book sticks to the facts. I surmise Bush knew what Powell was saying here, and it didn't fly, and so Powell felt that his conscience was clear. He had presented the alternatives. Other people have looked at it and said that Powell backed off, that he really didn't lay it on the line, that he did not speak his mind fully and openly and declare himself personally. And Powell's predecessor, Admiral Crow, chairman of the Joint Chiefs for 4 years before Powell came in, felt as a matter of principle that the number one military advisor to the president had an obligation, even if it was painful, even if it was unpopular, to lay it on the line and say, this is what I feel, this is my personal conclusion, you have my advice, you can accept it or reject it, but damn it, you're going to get it.
So is this a sign to you that real lively debate wasn't encouraged? What was encouraged was to go along with the majority or to go along with the president?
Well, one of the things the book shows in, I think, perhaps intricate way, is that these people who make these decisions, the inner Bush circle, they've known each other for years. Many of them worked together back in the Ford administration in the mid-70s. They tend to think alike. They're friends. They joke. There's an informality. There is a kind of ease with which they deal with each other. As in one point, it's pointed out that Scowcroft, the national security advisor, is kind of not just a mirror to Bush on policy issues, but more or less the all-purpose playmate to the president, going fishing, golfing, joking with him, and so forth. And that this is a kind of system that a number of members of the inner circle felt was just too informal, that there was not enough rigor to it. At the same time, and again, you have to look at all of the evidence in the book. There are many times When Bush did call in and listen to people, for instance, Pat Lang, the Defense Intelligence Agency officer, who had some very strong feelings during the crisis, was brought to the White House. And in great detail, I lay out the briefing that he and other members of the intelligence community gave to the president about a week before the war started. And what they said was very grim. They said, it's going to be a tough war. The Iraqi army is tough. They will fight. It's going to last a long time. And Bush said, well, lots of people have told me differently, but he looked them in the eye and he let them have their say. So there are occasions when there was a vigorous presentation of alternative views, and there were occasions when there was not.
You report that it was General Schwarzkopf's initial plan to attack straight into Iraqi forces. Now, we all know what ended up was that end run around. But you say that it was really Cheney and Powell who recommended that end run instead of penetrating right into the forces. What does that say about Schwarzkopf's planning?
Well, as the book outlines, this again occurred in the middle of the crisis. Schwarzkopf was building up a defense of Saudi Arabia. And this, as he told Bush right from the beginning, was going to take 4 months. 2 months into it, in October, Schwarzkopf all of a sudden got an order, send somebody to Washington with a secret briefing on what you would do when you went on the offense. And Schwarzkopf was furious and said, my God, I'm only halfway through constructing this defense. More and more Iraqi forces are coming into Kuwait. It's a much more serious military problem than it was back in August. And now some SOB wants the offensive plan. He had very short time to send somebody to Washington. He sent his chief of staff, General Johnston, a Marine general, who briefed it to Cheney and Powell in the Pentagon and then took it over to Bush. They had less than 48 hours to develop the plan, and it did, in fact, show our forces going right into the strength of Iraqi forces. Army doctrine in unclassified manuals outlines that you never do that, that you always go around, that you find some indirect way, by indirections or directions found. And so it was pretty obvious to anyone who really thought about it for any period of time that we were not going to go through the middle. But in fact, that was the plan presented to the Pentagon and the White House in October.
So you're saying Schwarzkopf presented that plan to make it clear that he had no choice but to do something that wasn't going to work, and that to do it right, he needed more time and more troops?
I think that's part of it, exactly. The point of all of this, of course, is you go back and you look at what happened, what was appearing in the newspapers and what was being broadcast was not the full story, that there was a lot of fury, a lot of anger, a lot of uncertainty, anxiety, contradictory messages, uncertainty about where we were going. It was not as smooth a process as it has been painted.
One last question. When you're researching the Pentagon, the decision makers, like in your book, The Commanders, is it usually the dissidents within the group who are willing to speak with you?
No. I try to talk to top-level, mid-level, low-level people. I try to talk to and wind up talking to people who agree with policy, people who disagree with policy, people who are making it, people who are arguing against it. In this case, in the book, for instance, there's a 60 or so page section on just the first 6 or 7 days of the crisis. And I know I interviewed hundreds of people about those meetings and discussions, and some of them were upset, some of them were delighted, some of them were neutral, and they're at all kinds of levels. And so by doing that, you have a better chance of approximating and then eventually establishing what happened.
But what about that fraternity, you know, that just doesn't want private things made public?
Well, I think the president feels that way. When my book came out, he pounded the table and was quite upset about it, and then wound up confirming that, of course, Powell made recommendation that was different, but saluted when the president decided. I obviously don't agree with that. I can understand that he tries to keep things private. I don't think, I think, if I may say this, the president overreacts to the idea that somebody who makes a recommendation and then it leaks out that he made this recommendation that, say, someone like Powell or Baker made a recommendation that was not accepted, and that that's going to keep them from speaking freely at meetings in the future. I mean, they're big guys. They know that all their recommendations are not going to be accepted. They're mature people who have been in government for decades, understand the process, and I think the president has too much of an emotional reaction to the idea of, oh my God, we're going to make X or Y look bad if we let it out. This is now history. Government's too important to just be left to the people who are in government, frankly. I think that the people need, people in the country need or have should have the opportunity to see it in action behind the scenes. That's the real measure, not the orchestrated press conferences and speeches and photo opportunities and availabilities and so forth. We're all manipulated on that. That's not real government. Real government is down in the office, four or six or 20 people sitting around the table saying, what the hell are we going to do about this? And in a sense, that is the measure of leadership, pro and con, much, much better than looking at somebody give a speech or handle a press conference.
Bob Woodward, I want to thank you very much for talking with us.
Thanks.
Bob Woodward's new book is called The Commanders. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.